for the sake of the of those who are running the tapes, this is Terry Fretheim. This is the third in a series on Old Testament justice, and this particular topic we've entitled, Does God Prefer Poor People? It may not be a question that we can answer, but we're going to work toward it. David stepped out of the room here, but I should say that David and I have not been in collusion with regard to the topics that we have decided to speak about this week. There has been no consultation whatsoever. And I think it was Ron back here who said there's obviously some conspiracy that's going on at higher levels. And so we will we'll ascribe it to the work of the Holy Spirit and move on. All of the material that that David read from Luke this morning, I think, has a significant a background in Old Testament material. And Jesus is reinforcing, really, Old Testament emphases that one can find throughout the Old Testament. And perhaps one could say Jesus is, and it, and the secondary level, Luke is. So one of the things I'd like to do is I'd like to parallel in some ways today what David did first hour by reading some Old Testament passages and just getting them out in front of you so that maybe some of the parallels between Old Testament and New Testament can be seen even more sharply. But before I do that, I'd like to just to do a couple of things, some introductory comments and then some historical comments that may help you understand some of the passages that we read a little bit better. Maybe as a way of focusing your mind on this issue, think about these questions. Suppose you were asked to write a description of your city or town, community, for some visitors who were coming in. What individuals in your town would you choose to talk about? My guess is it would be the mayor, some professional people, some of the more prominent people that you know in your community. What issues important to your community would you discuss? What issues important to your community would you discuss? My guess is that it would be issues that lifted up your community in a positive way, that would make your community look good. And that would mean for you, almost certainly, some positive programs, some new ventures on the part of the community. And if you were to take your visitor, if you were to plan on taking your visitor on a ride through your town, you're going to take this person on a little visit, which places would you choose to visit and which places would you choose to avoid? If we were in Minneapolis, we would take them along the West River Road to see all the fine houses and the parks. Take them along Summit Avenue in St. Paul, where the governor lives. You got all these ancient mansions, historical interest. We might even take them out to Edina to see some of those homes. My guess is that we would not take them into the near north side of Minneapolis, where we have people who live on the lower side of life. We'd not take them into the streets immediately south of the Minneapolis Loop, where the Native American community is largely centered. Now, compare your reflections on those questions to what the Old Testament does. And if you were to consider yourself a visitor to ancient Israel. And the Old Testament is a kind of map to find your way through that community. And where do you find the Old Testament taking you? It's really amazing where you're taken. There are some positive features about Israel that are lifted up for your attention. But you'd be surprised, and no doubt you have been surprised from time to time, that the story that's told there refuses to hide the negative, the tragic. It refuses to push under the rug the troubled side of life in that community. While there is attention given to key leaders like David and so forth, there's an amazing amount of attention given to the disadvantaged, to the poor, to the mistreated. And again, we'll see in these passages how the Old Testament makes very prominent the cause for the poor. And in this sense, I suppose you could say that the Bible, because now we want to add Luke and other Old New Testament passages and put them alongside of this, the Bible is a revolutionary document in many ways because of this. Because it refuses to kowtow to the wealthy, to the affluent, to the advantaged, for the sake of making a point, for the sake of making Israel appear good. Again and again, we're asked to look at the world through the eyes of the poor and the needy and the oppressed. And we ourselves, David pointed this out this morning, we ourselves again and again find ourselves on the outside looking in on a world that's unfamiliar to us. It's not our world and it makes us feel uncomfortable. A few historical comments, if I may. The laws that we're going to take a look at, we're going to look primarily today at social legislation. Tomorrow, we're going to look at preaching. And Saturday, we're going to look at prayers. The whole range of Old Testament material manages to deal in a prominent way with this material. But today, social legislation. The oldest material, oldest social legislation that you have in the Old Testament is in Exodus 20 to 24. It dates from a very early period in Israel's life. The concern for the poor, the needy, and the disadvantaged, these are concerns that scholars believe go back into the very earliest stages of Israel's life. This is not late material, it's early material. While measures for the relief of the poor and the concern for the poor are found to some degree in the culture surrounding Israel in Mesopotamia, you can see some of this in the Code of Hammurabi coming out of the early second millennium, for example, there is in the Old Testament a kind of attention given to issues surrounding the poor that you do not find, at least in the known, extra-biblical material in the surrounding cultures. Now, I think it's important for understanding some of these materials to move into that time when Israel was just settling in the land of promise in the book of Joshua. Some people get awfully frustrated when they read the book of Joshua. The first half of the book of Joshua is concerned about, you know, Joshua leading the people in battle and you conquer this part of the country and that part of the country. And then about halfway through the book of Joshua, things are pretty well set. And then all of a sudden you read, and the last half of the book of Joshua, chapters 13 to 20 in particular, have to do with the apportionment of the land among the tribes. And I think anyone reading that tends to skip over that pretty quickly. What's the point of all that? The point of all of that is very crucial. It's only now beginning to be recognized what the point of all that is. The apportionment of the land in equal terms to the persons who are now a part of this promised territory. The purpose for all that material is to demonstrate the importance of equality and egalitarianism in terms of a distribution of property. You recall the 12 tribes, the different portions of the land are given to 12 tribes, and they're different sizes. The tribes are different sizes in terms of population. Territory within the tribal units is distributed on the basis of clans, larger, that would be a group between tribe and family, distributed equally among the clans. The clans retain the rights to the property, and they distribute it equally to families. The families do not own the land. The families cannot sell the land. There is no such thing as private familial ownership of land in ancient Israel in the earliest laying out of the territory. So the same economic basis, the same economic opportunity was given. Now, what begins to happen? Over a period of time, this equality began to deteriorate. And true parity in land distribution just disappeared pretty quickly. For what reasons? You get the acquisition of new territory, which is not distributed equality. There are differences in the capability of landowners, so that land began to get pushed and pulled around. There are the growth of cities, and greater populations in the cities means that you get traditional family ties to the land that begin to break down and shift economic points of gravity. Wealth becomes more and more concentrated in the hands of a few over a period of time. One of the most important developments, however, in what happens to a breakdown and these issues of parity is war. The many wars in Israel negatively affected family life. And so you get in the material, you see all kinds of references to the widow, the orphan, because the fathers and the husbands are being killed in war. The widow and the orphan and the sojourner, or what should be translated in our translation, refugee. Because the north part, 10 northern tribes are conquered first by Assyria, the south remains, and people stream from the northern tribes down into the area of Jerusalem. And they're refugees. And these materials begin to speak to them. So what happens in the light of these developments? Okay, you get the original situation which is laid out in Exodus. And then with these negative developments, in terms of equality in the community, you have three types of responses to this. On the one hand, you get the response of social legislation. And we'll find this now in the passages that we read in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, particularly with the war developments and how they shift some of the materials and expand the materials that are already in Exodus and talk about particular problems faced by later times that need to be addressed in the area of social legislation. A second kind of response comes from the prophets. And here's where the preachers come into play. The preacher, we'll look at that tomorrow. How do the preachers handle this burgeoning problem of inequality in ancient Israel? And then Saturday, we want to look at the Psalms, where those responsible for worship are in the business of preparing materials which are to be used particularly by those who have been mistreated and are disadvantaged. So that's our scheme here. It's often said that the problem of justice is an aspect of the problem of power. That's to say, the strong and the affluent in society can be counted on to take care of themselves. But at least some of the powerful, will inevitably use their power, perhaps often unconsciously, to exploit those who are an inferior or a disadvantageous position. To state it somewhat too simply, but I think to get this point across as we focus in now on social legislation, the function of the law function of the law for Israel was to protect the weak, the less powerful, from exploitation by the more powerful. Now, one of the things, however, that Israel is concerned about in social legislation, you see this in the passage, they are not interested in this matter simply from the perspective of a social problem. It's not simply a sociological issue for Israel. It's not simply a political issue. What political issue for Israel? One of the real problems, I think, in contemporary American life, as well as in other cultures, is that the political issues regarding social legislation tend to be separated out from the life of the church, and to get them together becomes a problem. And so how do we connect God with the social legislation that needs to be done, that is being done? Well, Israel never forgot that God was the one who gave the social legislation. God was the one who gave the law. It is fundamentally, social legislation is fundamentally a theological matter. It's not simply a social matter or a political matter. It's fundamentally theological. So the social legislation is ascribed to God. It's believed to be something that God has given and not something that is simply of human making. Now, justice is first and foremost what God does and what God is about. And so God, in giving social legislation, chooses to, God decides, that the people ought to comport themselves in daily life by the way in which God himself has acted in history. Let me just begin to read a few passages so that you could see some of this. Deuteronomy 10 is a key passage here. The particular section begins with verse 12, but I'd like to go down to verse 17. The Lord your God is God of gods, Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the terrible God. That's a bad word in some ways. Who is not partial. We'll come back to that issue. Who is not partial and takes no bribe. God executes justice for the fatherless and the widow, and loves the refugee, giving him food and clothing. Therefore, you love the refugee, for you were refugees in the land of Egypt. Now, do you see that move? God has acted in a justice, out of a concern for justice, on behalf of the poor and the exploited of Israel in the land of Egypt. Israel is to comport itself in life as God has acted, so that for Israel, the actions toward the poor and the disadvantaged are basically concerned with an imitation of God. Imitation of God. David at the end of the hour this morning. Be merciful as the Lord your God is merciful. That's the move that's made here again and again and again. Now let me go to a few more passages. I want to read the one that's perhaps the most troublesome of all the passages dealing with the poor, and makes us all very nervous. Exodus chapter 22, beginning with verse 21. This is amongst the oldest materials now. You shall not wrong a stranger. You shall not oppress a stranger. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. Now, if you do afflict them, and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, God says, and my wrath will burn, and I'll kill you. I'll kill you. That's a hard word. I don't have God saying that sort of thing very often in any biblical material. I'll kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children shall become fatherless. Very strong word. Let me move from that to some passages in Leviticus. Leviticus 25 is a chapter that has an awful lot to say about war. It's kind of a refrain that occurs here, beginning of a number of the sections, verse 25, verse 35, verse 39. If your brother becomes poor, that's the theme. If your brother becomes poor. Now again, we're moving down into a later era when a lot of brothers and sisters became poor. Okay? A lot of brothers and sisters became poor. Let me just read verses 35 forward. If your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall maintain him. Okay? As simple as that, folks, is it? As a stranger and a refugee, he shall live with you. Take no interest from him, but fear your God. That's an interesting juxtaposition, isn't it? Take no interest from him, but fear your God, that your brother may live beside you. You shall not lend him your money at interest, nor give him your food for profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you forth out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. Notice the connection, the close connection made there between what God has done and what the people are asked to do. Or to move back into Leviticus 19. Leviticus 19 is the source, of course, of the famous second commandment, so to speak, of Jesus. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus is just simply quoting Leviticus 19 at that point. And Leviticus 19 has a number of passages which are of interest in this connection. But let me just read verses 33 and 34. When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. The stranger who sojourns with you, the refugee who sojourns with you shall be to you as the natives are among you. That's interesting language. They shall be to you as the natives are. And you shall love him as yourself. You shall love him as yourself. Why? Well, you remember, folks, you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You were refugees in the land of Egypt. I'm the Lord your God. There are some materials in Leviticus that don't follow quite the same pattern. But I'd like to, first day we were together, I read that section about, in Leviticus 14, about the importance of housing. And that God is concerned about sick houses and the dwellings in which people live and the importance of issues of housing for ancient Israel. In Leviticus 13, you've got an interesting section on clothing. The language here is a little bit different from what we've read so far, but I think that I should just read a few passages here to give you some sense of this. Beginning with verse 47, chapter 13. When there's a leprous disease, now what they're talking about here is mold or mildew or kind of spoiled clothing, if you were. When there's a leprous disease in a garment, whether a woolen or linen garment, in warp or woof of linen or wool, or in a skin, or in anything made of skin, If the disease shows greenish or reddish in the garment, whether in warp or woof or in skin or anything made of skin, it is a leprous disease and shall be shown to the priest. Now, pastors, those of you, okay, you get an important role that pastors play. And the priest shall examine the disease and shut up the garment which has the disease for 7 days. And then he shall examine the disease on the seventh day, and if the disease has spread in the garment, in warp or woof, or in the skin, whatever be the use of the skin, the disease is a malignant leprosy, it is unclean. And he shall burn the garment, whether diseased in warp or woof, woolen or linen, or anything of skin, for it's a malignant leprosy, and it shall be burned in the fire. Now, how often have you heard this passage used in the church? What's the concern here? The concern is that people have clothing that's not contaminated in one form or another. Now, we today, and that's the constant challenge, when we get to some particulars in mode, it's the constant challenge for us, how can we take that ancient Israelite setting and, you know, put it into our day and use different language to meet the same concern? What's the underlying concern in the passage? The underlying concern in the passage is this, that it's God's concern that people have clothing that is in good shape, that's appropriate for wearing. One of the reasons why I like this section of Leviticus is verse 40. If a man's hair has fallen from his head, and it goes on, he is bald, but he is clean. It's amazing what you can find in the text that is of interest. It goes on. Let me read one more before I ask you to respond a little bit to what you've been hearing. Deuteronomy 15. Yesterday we talked about the fact that this social legislation is often presented to us in terms that are not like an external code, but have to do with concern for attitudes, concern for the suggestion, the kind of inculcation of the way in which one perceives and thinks about things. One of the troubles I have with Matthew, in particular, in the New Testament, is that when some of Jesus' statements, you've heard that it was said of old, but I say unto you, suggesting that the Old Testament wasn't concerned about what was in the heart, but was only concerned about externals. But one of the things you find in the Deuteronomic passage here, particularly in 15 and in many other such passages, is the concern for the heart. Let me begin with verse 1 of chapter 15 of Deuteronomy. At the end of every 7 years you shall grant a release. What they're talking about here is forgiving debts. If there are any bankers in this group, you're in trouble here with regard to, or anybody who's lent anything to anybody else. This is the matter of the release. Every creditor shall release what he has lent to his neighbor. Okay? You've lent any money on the seventh year, you got to give it, forgive it. Just forgive it. He shall not exact it of his neighbor, his brother, because the Lord's release has been proclaimed. Now, of a foreigner, you may exact it. But whatever yours is with your brother, your hand shall release. Now, let me go to verse 7. Here's where you really begin to get some preaching almost as a part of the social legislation. If there is among you a poor man, one of your brothers and sisters, in any of your towns within your land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother and sister, but you shall open your hand to them, and you shall lend them sufficient for their need, whatever it may be. Now take heed. Take heed lest there be a base thought in your heart and you say, well, the seventh year, the year of release is near me. Next year I'm going to have to forgive all this business. I'm not going to lend them any money now. and your eye be hostile to your poor brother and sister, and you give them nothing, and they cry to the Lord against you, and it is sin in you, you shall give to them freely, and your heart shall not be grudging when you give to them. Because for this the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in all that you undertake. For the poor will never cease out of the land. Therefore I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brother and sister, to the needy and to the poor in the land. Imagine anything more forceful than that kind of combination of social legislation and preaching with respect to the treatment of the poor. I think I should set alongside that one other passage in Deuteronomy having to do with the wealthy, so that gets a little context for this. When, beginning with verse 7 of Deuteronomy 8, the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, fountains and springs, flowing forth in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. That's interesting. And you shall eat and be full, and you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land that he has given you. But take heed. Take heed, lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments. Lest, when you've eaten, and you're full, and you have houses, and you live in them, and when your herds and all your flocks have been multiplied, and your silver and your gold is multiplied, and then your heart be lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, keeping down. Beware lest you say in your heart, well, my power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth. You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is God who gives you power to get wealth, that he may confirm his covenant which he swore to your fathers as at this day. Well, what do you think? Yes?
Is this the 8? It seems to me that this is the text that's pointed at LBW for Thanksgiving.
It is.
But it stops at verse 10.
Is that right?
Or does it?
I don't know.
I think so. I don't know if it goes on to deal with the rest of it.
Probably. That's common in the lectionary system, that they leave out the most challenging passages.
The other thing is that the 15 passage could apply to Social Security, our system of Social Security. And one of the things that's interesting to me, I have read very little of it, but the preliminary Catholic bishop's document on the economy, or the section on the poor, is in contradiction to that, because it says, the bishop's document says that our system, while it provides for the poor, makes it very difficult to be poor, because the poor are so heavily scrutinized. It's very difficult for the poor in our Social Security system to get help.
Thank you for that. Other comments, questions here? Yes?
Is the Old Testament prophet speaking only in terms of the people of Israel? Are they speaking about people who are from other countries and nationalities as well? I mean, very often I hear within the church that we're called to take care of our people in the church, but those people outside, they don't skip over the ground. You know, if they join the church, then you can.
Yeah. I think it would be true to say that the primary reference in this material is fellow Israelites. But you also get that refugee issue in there. Sometimes scholars have translated that word in Hebrew, ger, or plural gerim, is resident alien. You see that language around sometimes. And there will be or the word stranger is sometimes translated to. And that has reference not simply to refugees, say Jewish or Israelite refugees from within the country, but from those from outside as well.
Seems like that's a nice escape, and you can make it smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
Our congregation.
Yeah, that's one of the things that really you need to be attentive to is, particularly now, when in the last few minutes, what I want to do is I want to show you some of the very specific things that Deuteronomy recommends in terms of treatment of the poor. I mean, he doesn't simply talk about you got to treat the poor, you know, give freely. He's got some very specific things that he's going to suggest as to how to do this. And one of the things that we'll want to be asking is, well, obviously, we can't do this literally today. I mean, we can't follow what Deuteronomy says. I mean, our economy is different. Our social situation is different. What we're called to do is we're called to look under these particular legal, this social legislation that you've got there, and see what the basic concern is, and then use your imagination to determine how is it in our own situation that we can do the same thing with our particular resources. Our problem constantly is that, well, it doesn't say that literally there, it doesn't apply to us, so we can escape. Yes?
Even if we were to apply it on a very small level of our own congregation and do it well, we would have people hoarding into our churches just because of the needs that were being met.
Yeah.
And I think it gets to be a cop-out, you know, we'll wait for the government to do it, forgetting that we could be doing it within the confines of our local congregation and doing it well there, and we don't even try.
That's my question.
Yeah, I think that the church often suffers from a poor imagination when it comes to how to take concerns like these and make them live in our community. Yes.
I think both in the Old Testament passages and the Luke passages this morning, I think I forget that the Bible talks about lent and money. For some reason, you know, that's just something easy to ignore. And in my sinfulness, we live and work in a, serve and worship in a low-income area, and we have loaned money to lots of people. And I can't begin to tell you who they all are, but I can tell you in my sinfulness who the ones are that haven't paid us back. Which is what you remember, which is really against everything that's been both Old Testament and New Testament today, is that, you know, we should lend without thinking of getting it back. And yet, I don't think American people, in general, think of lending, period. And one of the things, you know, I've heard a number of times is you know, don't ever lend money to your friends. That's the end of the friendship. And that kind of, I mean, you know, we hear those kind of things and forget that the Bible, at least I do, forget that the Bible has that much to say about money.
Or, let me extend that. I think that's exactly the point. And we'll take a look at a couple of other passages, which get very specific about that. To extend that a little bit, we do some of these things for people, and then people aren't grateful to us, and so we're not going to do that again.
Yeah.
I mean, they're so ungrateful. I mean, how can you expect us to reach out to them?
Yeah.
I mean, at least we deserve some thank yous for what we're about here, don't we? I mean, after all.
Isn't that an interesting line in Luke? Do this for God is kind to the ungrateful and selfish.
Yes, I underlined that when you read it. I was cheating and reading along while you were doing it. That's it.
I think it was Luther who said that the last thing to be converted is the pocketbook.
What if your pocketbook is generous, and yet by your giving to somebody, you encourage in them something that is not good? I guess we've had many instances of people coming to our home, and we have given to them, and yet we find out that this is their lifestyle, to live by 20s and 25s and little scams. And what you're actually doing is encouraging them to continue in that because they received something from you. That's been a real problem for me. I'm having trouble giving because of that.
How might you respond to that sort of
objection? I live close to the street. And one of the things that I have great joy in is what I call my pastor's fund. It is all the money that might come my way because of baptisms or counseling or weddings or whatever.
And so it's always out of money in one sense, but the people of the town know that that's available. And so they come and they ask. And when there's nothing in there because someone hasn't paid back something they promised, they get a no. And when they con me, I go after them. And I break late. It's not a problem. And they discover that the con has to give way to the concern, and that if we really are neighbors and love and care for each other, that there is accountability and there is consequences and there is a very real relationship that goes beyond whatever you might share, so that the money or the clothes or the next lodging or whatever it is you might be bartering for gets dealt with, but the base is always the relationship. And when you, it's the biggest delight in my life is when I get somebody on welfare coming by and saying, I need a load of wood, and they have just a little bit of gas, and so I give them a little bit more gas, and the phone rings, and somebody else says, I need a load of wood, but I don't have anything to bring it in, and the person coming for the first load of wood says, we're here to get wood, and I say, well, you got to pick up a little bit more gas. How about if you take this load over to this gal and then come back and get your own? And they do, and all of a sudden they're transformed from a recipient to a sharing neighbor, and they find themselves saying, gee, that was sort of fun.
That's very interesting, Ron. I think it's the issues that you raised are very real. We I think often don't relate ourselves to these people very well. I think part of that has to do with the fact that we'd like to get rid of them as quickly as possible. And so this continuing relationship with them is something that seems to me might be a way in which, again, our imaginations might be working for us to help prevent some of those misuses that you know, often creep into our policies and practices here in this area. Yeah.
Harry, I just want to make a comment. You raise issues that we should have a forum, for example, a forum on church and state, and how separate should church and state be? These are very critical, difficult things to deal with. But an example would be being kind to refugees, the sanctuary movement, and the federal justice system judging that kind of thing. The whole issue you could just throw wide open and have a great forum on it.
I think it's right. And let me say, to the great credit of the American Lutheran Church and the Presbyterian Church, that they have taken the government to court in the state of Arizona on precisely that issue. I mean, I think that there is an example, a contemporary example, of some courageousness. I mean, they've taken a lot of the letters that have poured in on that one have been just an immense stream here. But I think that's a wonderful instance of how biblical materials are actually being put to use.
I might be interested in one way in which some of the early Christians dealt with this statement, give to everyone who begs. In the teaching of the 12 apostles, the Didache, there's a line quoted from the Sermon on the Mount, give to everyone who begs. And immediately after it, it says, indeed, there's another saying, let your donation sweat in the palm of your hand until you know to whom to give it.
That's it.
Like you have two proverbial sayings, side by side, contradicting, but you live within the polarities of them. And that the holding it is never an excuse for a lack of generosity.
That's nice. I like that. Yes?
I have a little problem of, I don't have as much problem with individuals that come with me, but when it comes to a community like Butte, Montana, that has had a mass unemployment situation all of a sudden, and you have an organizational kind of community organization that is established that has maybe a sister from the Catholic Church, and some other people who try to do some systemic things related to electric bills and rent and to alleviate problems like that, and then get all static in the community that we should be involved in.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, and not only from the community you get the static, you get the static from within the congregation, that that church shouldn't be involved in any kind of organizational project of dealing with welfare or low income.
I think you're right that our society today is much more complex in terms of the problems that arise and the way in which you have to address issues than the red tape that you have to go through, etc., to get things done. The static that you have to put up with, I agree with you, it's a very complicated matter. And I like to suggest that these biblical materials provide, it's a basic social legislation that provides a vision for us, a direction for us, an attitude for us, and invites us to use our imaginations to expand and find out ways that we can be responding to this concern in our own contemporary situation, no matter how complex it is. We're invited not to give up simply because of the complexity, but to continue to try and work at this. Let me just read a couple of passages more that I think give some particularity to the concern for the poor. Deuteronomy 24, beginning with verse 19. When you reap your harvest in your field, and you've forgotten a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the refugee, the fatherless and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the works of your hands. And when you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over them a second time. It shall be for the refugee, the fatherless, and the widow. And when you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not go over them a second time. It shall be for the refugee, the fatherless, and the widow. You shall remember you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this.
Makes you think of Ruth gleaning in the fields.
Yeah, exactly. That's a specific illustration of the application of this particular legislation. But, now you say, well, there are all kinds of problems in that. Or how can you take that particular legislation and, you know, apply it to a non-rural situation? Well, you're invited to use your imagination. It's interesting how they did not ignore some suggestions for the poor in how they were to respond to that particular legislation. So at the end of chapter 23 of Deuteronomy, listen to what they have to say to the poor. When you go into your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat your fill of grapes, as many as you wish, but you shall not put any into your basket. And when you go into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the ears with your hand, but you shall not put a sickle to your neighbor's standing grain. Kind of interesting sort of limitations built in to that particular process. A recognition that there were some problems there, just like the ones that you have brought up. Well, let's see how we can deal with them, how we can work with them. Or look at Deuteronomy 24:10 following. When you make your neighbor a loan of any sort, you shall not go into his house to fetch his pledge. His pledge would be the security that he would be given, that would be commonly a garment, a piece of clothing. Why would he say that? You shall not go into his house to fetch his pledge. You shall stand outside the house, and the man to whom you make the loan shall bring the pledge out to you. Intriguing passage, because it has a particular concern for the feelings of a person who has to borrow. You don't go and barge into his house and say, okay, I've given you some money, but you allow the person the self-respect to come out of the house, and in maybe more private ways, you know, take care of this particular problem or issue. I think a very striking sensitivity to people's feelings. And if he is a poor man, you shall not sleep in his pledge. You should, if he's a poor man, and he gives you a garment as security for the loan, you shall not keep it overnight. Because for the poor man, it's probably the only thing he's got to sleep in. And so if you keep it overnight, he's not going to have a proper covering overnight. And so for heaven's sake, don't sleep in it. That's his. You give it back to him for the evening, okay? When the sun goes down, you shall release to him, restore to him the pledge that he may sleep in his own cloak and bless you. And it shall be righteousness to you before the Lord your God. Oh. It shall, you will more fully realize the relationship that you have with God. You will be doing justice to the relationship you have with God by doing such a very simple matter as not sleeping in the garment that the poor man has given to you for a pledge. Well, another passage that one might read just quickly here. There's a great concern as a result of and a recognition that the judicial system in ancient Israel was of crucial importance in dealing with these matters. And so you'll find in the Old Testament a lot of concern for the judiciary. And I think a passage like Deuteronomy 16, 18 following puts it in a nutshell. And it's one that we ought to regularly remind our lawyers. And I like the way in which you pick up those, what's your phrase, David, those legal experts. And the judges among us ought to have this as sort of above their desks, I think. Beginning with verse 18 of Deuteronomy 16, you shall appoint judges and officers in all of your towns, which the Lord your God gives you, according to your tribes. And they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You, it's a reference to the judges, you shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality. You shall not take a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and subverts the cause of the righteous. Justice, and only justice, shall you follow. And now comes the hooker, that you may live long upon the land which the Lord your God gives you. Well, the challenge here is to take passages like that, those particularities, and see if we can find ways of making them work in our more complex society. One of the problems here, of course, constantly, is that we're satisfied with the general word, love your neighbor, we're satisfied with the general word, take care of the poor, and we don't get down to particularities and use our imaginations to find ways of dealing with the problem. Yes?
One of the ways that on the West Coast, Snohomish County where we're living, there's a lot of farms and agricultural kind of things, and a gleaners organization has been started, and you sign up and you're trained for that, but you go out and glean and you can take home enough for your own use, but everything else that you glean is given to the food banks. So it's really a nice way to aid the food banks and also make it for yourself. So it's a kind of creative way of dealing with some of that, and direct reference to what they were saying about the excess.
You know what? There's also a very lively concern for tithing in Israel. And so that the concern for the poor gets drawn into Israel's worship life in a couple of important ways. Notice the tithing issue with regard to the poor. This is all of you think of your church budgets in the benevolence giving of your congregations and measure it over against this passage in Deuteronomy chapter 14, verses 28 following. At the end of every 3 years, you shall bring forth all the tithe of your produce in the same year and lay it up within your towns. And the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance with you, Levites, those are country preachers who were dispossessed when they centralized all the worship in Jerusalem. So these are really preachers who are without call. That's the Levites in Deuteronomy, okay? And the refugee and the fatherless and the widow who are within your town shall come and eat and be filled. In other words, a significant portion of the tithe was to be set aside for the poor. And it's kind of interesting, later on in Deuteronomy, it's almost as if saying, wait a minute now, you've got to be accountable for this tithe. And so in Deuteronomy 26, when you've finished paying all the tithe of your produce in the third year, which is the year of tithing, giving it to the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, that they may eat within your towns and be filled, then you shall say before the Lord your God. This means that you've got to go to the sanctuary, and you've got to say this. And they actually give you the quotation of what you have to say. I have removed the sacred portion out of my house, and moreover, I have given it to the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, according to all thy commandment which thou hast commanded me, and I have not transgressed any of thy commandments, neither have I forgotten them. I have not eaten of the tithe while I was mourning, or removed any of it while I was unclean, or offered any of it to the dead. I have obeyed the voice of the Lord my God. I have done according to all that thou hast commanded me. A public accounting for benevolence giving. That's what you got there. A public accounting for benevolence giving. You got to go and say, I have done this. In the also in the Deuteronomic legislation with regard to the festivals, you've got, it's kind of like, you got all these festivals, and they make sure that in every one of those festivals that you invite every person to come. When you have these festivals, you make sure that you invite the manservant and the maidservant, and you know, all of them are listed as to be invited in and participate in the worship life, the celebrations of the worship of the community of faith. Let me just take a couple of minutes to address the question. Does God prefer poor people? Fine. Well, God is impartial. And God loves all people. And God is concerned for all people. I think it is striking that it's the poor, it's the disadvantaged, it's the exploited who get mentioned in all these texts. There are no parallel texts that mention the rich, the wealthy, the affluent. God is especially concerned about these people. Why? Because they need more help. They need more attention if they are to be brought up to the level of well-being that God wants for all people. The strong, the affluent, certainly all of us here, do not need the same level of help from God or from others as do many of our brothers and sisters all across the globe. In that sense, they do get a kind of preferential treatment. Just as when my wife brought me to the hospital 15 minutes before we left for Holden, and I had a severe cut in my finger, they paid attention to me and not to her. But also, I think, it's the strong and the affluent who are often responsible for the exploitative conditions of the poor among us in ways beyond our knowing oftentimes. Every time you go to the grocery store, every time you do almost anything in life, you realize that you're making it more difficult for somebody in this world. God is then not only working for them, in some way he's also working against us. And so that means that God's activity in the world has that kind of force and predominance and preeminence to it. And I guess I have to say that I'm bothered by the fact that so often we begrudge God's generosity and all the goodness that we have received at his hand. We get a little uptight when we think that God might need to pay a little bit more attention. Somebody else. So, be it. There might be time for a question or two here. Yes?
I think we in America also, especially as Christians, can learn from our black brothers and sisters. I think our black brothers and sisters do a lot better on some of those things than we do, as far as taking in the family. In our own congregation, a number of our black families have cousins, grandchildren, brothers that they sort of just take in as part of the family.
Yeah.
And they care for them, and they're part of the family. And I've never heard them complain about it. I mean, some of us think we got enough with our own kids, you know, we don't need it sometimes, and somebody else.
Yeah.
They do it very well. And I think they also have a better spirit very often of sharing with those in need. Maybe because they've been there themselves.
They're much, much more close to God. That's very helpful. In other words, it's really an appeal to, hey, let's pay attention to what in fact is happening in Christian communities out and about, and learn from them. Yes?
I was likening this issue to a mother and a father who have several children, and one of them may be retarded or something else. So that one does get more care and more personal taking care of than the ones who are stronger and able to do for themselves.
Nice.
But within a family, there's still love for all of them. Each one loves the other. There's not any jealousy.
That's a nice illustration. I like that. Appreciate that. Yes?
I have what might be considered a trivia question regarding the forgiving of the debts after 7 years.
Yes.
Could our modern day statute of limitations have come from that? Have had any roots there?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know that. Maybe somebody else does. Wouldn't be surprised if one could track that back in some way, as having its ultimate roots there.
Isn't that unique that all this is seven, that perfect number?
Okay.
Terry?
Yes?
This is unrelated to borrowing. Besides begrudging the poor the extra attention God gives them, we seem to begrudge our enemies certain things. And I go to a quote that says, "The price of peace is the happiness of our enemies." In other words, we have to pay the price to make our enemies happy before we will have peace. And in effect, that's really God's attention to the poor, something we have to be identified with the poor before we realize the extra attention God is giving to the poor.
That's nice. Maybe I can say, I think say the same thing by doing some different words there. If in fact God's hands and feet are commonly ours, then the massive attention that ought to be given to such persons by the Christian community becomes a way in which God himself is involved in that sort of, if you will, preferential treatment. Well, tomorrow we have we want to talk about prophets and their use of their concern for this particular issue. And one of the things that we'll find is that the prophets pick up on a lot of this social legislation, and they make use of it in particular ways in preaching. Okay. Thank you.